This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hundreds of millions more people will be flooded out by the sea. What can be defended? What cities, deltas, or whole countries will be lost? Let's hear directly from the scientists on this important new science from Scott Culp and Benjamin Krauss at Climate Central. But we start with Dr. Jonathan Bamber, the British expert not part of this study. We hear why expert judgment jumped from 1 meter high-end sea level rise by the year 2100 to 2 meters, well over 6 feet higher seas. Brand new coastlines are possible by the end of this century. And a murky worry for all is something called Antarctic instability. We journey into the science of the past and the future. I'm Alex Smith. You may not find inflatable life jackets under your seat during this trip. Astounding new science finds the amount of land and people exposed to sea level rise has been wildly underestimated. At least 100 million more people will be flooded out this century. And a lot of that new seawater is coming from melting ice at the poles. Professor Jonathan Bamber is a specialist in the Great Ice Melt, providing data used by scientists around the world. Dr. Bamber is from the Bristol Glaciology Center at UK's University of Bristol. We reached Jonathan Bamber in Toulouse, France. Jonathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak on the program.
Well, your work is critical when trying to understand how radically coastlines will change for this generation and the next. But first, let's talk about this astounding new paper in Nature Communications titled New Elevation Data Triples Estimates of Global Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Coastal Flooding. And of course, that is not news for you. What did you get from the lead author, Scott Culp's presentation at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union last year?
Well, I saw the title of the talk in the program, and I thought, well, that's a must-go-to session. I've done a lot of work with something called digital elevation models. That's land surface topography, mainly derived from satellite data, but sometimes from ground-based data as well. It's a very interesting study. What they've done is looked at the most commonly used digital elevation model for determining global land surface elevations, and it's a model called SRTM, which is the Shuttle Radar Topographic Mission, and it was flown about 15 years ago or something like that, and it's one of the most commonly used data. It's not the only one, but it's the one that is used by many groups to assess the vulnerability of coastal communities to sea level rise and coastal flooding and other natural hazards in coastal areas. And they looked at the accuracy of SRTM in coastal areas and produced a new DEM that they've called Coastal DEM, which improves the representation in coastal areas. But in essence, there's a bias in SRTM, a high bias. In other words, in coastal areas, SRTM is giving you elevations that are typically a few meters too high. And they've corrected that bias, more or less. You know, I mean, you know, there are inaccuracies in all global data sets, but they've certainly reduced the bias and reduced the random error, the sort of, you know, the what's called the standard deviation, the random errors in the DEM. And by doing that, they discovered that, or one of the conclusions of their study was that it's around about three times more people are going to be exposed to coastal flooding than was predicted using the SRTM DEM. That's the kind of headline of that study.
It sounds to me like the NASA's shuttle radar data was accepting things like treetop levels in forests and building tops in urban areas as though that was ground level. Is that correct?
Well, look, I mean, we've known that for a long time because one of the uses for digital elevation models is to define watersheds and to determine where water is going to flow in, not in coastal areas, but in inland areas. And so if you look at somewhere like Amazon Forest, well, SRTM is actually of limited value there because it's just measuring the canopy top elevation, not what's called the bare earth elevation. And obviously, in urban areas or heavily vegetated areas, particularly like rainforests, SRTM doesn't penetrate the surface or buildings, and it doesn't measure what's called the bare earth elevation. So we have known that, but I guess it's been quite a challenge to improve on that product. And it's not everywhere that you get a bias. I mean, obviously, if you have some very open coastal area with low-lying vegetation and no urban development, then the bias is likely to be quite low.
You know, what surprises me, too, though, is that apparently we in the public and policymakers didn't know that this error that's known in scientific circles was happening, and now it sort of comes to us as a big shock. Well, you mean you didn't know what the actual elevation of the land was in so many key areas?
Well, look, I mean, that's the scientific process. I mean, we're constantly, you know, improving on our understanding and knowledge of all parts of the Earth system and, you know, everything that's going on. You know, I mean, Voyager 2's just gone outside of the solar system, hasn't it? You know, I mean, everything is, we're constantly improving our understanding and, you know, chipping away at some of the uncertainties. And, yeah, we understood that there are uncertainties in SRTM. What they have done in this study is they've quantified them and they've shown that there is really quite a significant bias in particular coastal areas and areas where there's heavy urban development and lots of vegetation. And they have quantified the effect of that on the impacts on populations. I think that's the kind of the big advance that they've done in this study, which, you know, does, as I say, it increases the number of people that they are expected to be at risk of, let's say, annual flood events or that are going to lie below the mean high water tide level by about a factor three, which is quite a big difference. So in the study that we did, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, we had an estimate for the number of people that we thought would be affected or potentially displaced by a 2 meter sea level rise, and the value we came up with, which came from the literature prior to this study, was 190 million people. Well, that is now, according to this study, more like 600 million. And to put that in perspective, 600 million, that is the tenth of the population of the planet right now, or roughly. You know, that's a lot of people. It's twice the population of the U.S.
Yeah, now, not all those people are going to have to just run away from where they are. I mean, they're talking about annual flood events are possible at the start of things, and I think people will adapt somewhat, but it's still pretty shocking that the ocean is going to start flooding into so many people's lives in this century.
You're absolutely right. I think we should be clear that we're not saying that 600 million people are going to have to leave their homes, you know, straight away, but if you think that your house is going to be flooded like once a year, that's, you know, that's not going to be very pleasant. It's not going to be much fun. It's going to make life fairly difficult. And in addition, I mean, there will be communities that will have to move inland. They'll have to migrate from coastal areas because they'll become uninhabitable. One of the consequences of sea level rise is what's called salinification. So that is basically the intrusion of salt water into freshwater groundwater in coastal areas. Once that happens, and once you don't have a natural freshwater supply in a coastal area, well, then, you know, it becomes very difficult to continue living there. So, I mean, there will be migration inland. There will be people that are displaced, but it's not 600 million, for example.
Well, even when we do get a better estimate of what land is really within 2 meters or about 6 feet of the current sea level, we need to know how much that sea level will change and by when, and that is where your work contributes a lot. How much of coming sea level rise will come from the melting ice world, the cryosphere?
Look, that's the $64 million question, which we'd all like to answer in one way or another. And I don't think we've got that long. I could spend several hours trying to explain, you know, give you an answer to that question. There are various different ways we can tackle that question. There are several factors that influence sea level rise, and there are three that are sort of very important. There's one which is thermal expansion of the ocean. So when the ocean warms, it expands, sea level goes up. And that's something that we understand pretty well, and there are uncertainties around how much heat will be absorbed by the ocean over the next century. but those uncertainties are not so great. So we have a pretty good handle on thermal expansion, okay? And that, you know, it's going to be on the order of 20 to 30 centimeters or of that order. It depends on the climate warming scenario, the trajectory we follow. But, you know, we've got a fairly good handle on that. The second component is melting of glaciers, mountain glaciers around the world. So that's all the ice outside of Antarctica and Greenland. Now, if you melted all of the glaciers, that's like all the glaciers in the Rockies, the Andes, the Himalayas, in the Arctic, outside of Greenland, everything, that would contribute about 45 centimeters to sea level. Now, it's not all going to disappear by 2100, but maybe in a what we call a business-as-usual type scenario, maybe half of that, about 20 centimeters, will come from glaciers around the world. The third component is the ice sheets. Now, the ice sheets contain 99.5% of all the ice on the planet. If you melted Antarctica and Greenland tomorrow and you dumped them in the ocean, you'd raise global sea level by 65 meters. Now, to people in the U.S., that's, over 200 feet. So the ice sheets have the potential to have a really big impact on sea level rise over the next century. But the problem with the ice sheets is that they're actually not particularly well understood. Their response to climate change and to changes in what we call external forcing, in other words, like what the oceans do and what the atmosphere does, are not that well understood. We have models of ice sheets which are relatively sophisticated, but they don't include certain important processes, and there is a debate about what processes are important and what aren't, and so there's a large uncertainty surrounding what the ice sheets are going to do over the next century, or actually next few centuries. So rather than take a modeling approach, what we did was a method, an approach called structured expert judgment. I guess I should explain a little bit what that is.
What is that?
Yeah. It's a method that's been used, if I sort of introduce it, a method that's been used very extensively for assessing the risks and the uncertainties surrounding what are called low probability, high impact events. So the examples of those are that there's about, I think, is it sort of 50 or 60,000 people that live on the island of Montserrat. In the center of Montserrat is a volcano, an active volcano. So it's absolutely critical for those people living there to have some handle on what the likelihood of an eruption is in the next few days, you know, so you can assess whether you need to evacuate those people. So volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, the risk of things like what's called rad waste, radioactive waste leakage, dam failures, all of these sorts of things that are actually, we have some understanding about what processes influence these things. You know, we know something about mechanics of volcanoes and earthquakes, but the models are not adequate for giving you predictions. And that's the position we're in with ice sheets. And so what you do is you take as many of the sort of world-leading experts that have published or have an understanding of this particular field. You bring them together, and we organize two workshops, one in the U.S. and one in Europe. You go through a series of questions which you know the answer to, but they don't. And that's what's called the sort of calibration phase. That's the structured bit to the expert judgment. So what we're doing by asking these questions is determining the expert's ability to assess their own uncertainty in something. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And so this is a process that can be applied to climate change and particularly to things like sea level rise, for example. Now, in 2013, you and W.P. Aspinall published a paper that used expert judgment assessment, and you said in that paper that you suggested a conceivable risk of sea level rise of greater than a meter by 2100, but your latest on the subject, published in April 2019 in PNAS, says, quote, "Our findings support the use of scenarios of 21st century global total sea level rise exceeding 2 meters for planning purposes." Why did you go from talking about 1 meter to 2 meters in just 6 years?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And the first thing I should say is those numbers are not mine. I didn't generate them. They came from this structured expert judgment exercise where we pool the expertise of the world's leading experts. In the most recent exercise, it's about 23 people from North America and Europe, where we pulled their expertise and we asked them what they think their best judgments. It's not a guess, it's a judgment of what they think the ice sheets are going to do. And why have the numbers changed? Why have they effectively doubled? There have been some studies in the last 5 or 6 years that have suggested, that imply that, in particular, the Antarctic ice sheet is more vulnerable to warming, is could respond faster than we previously believed, in essence. There was an influential paper published in 2016 by two US scientists, Rob DeConta and Dave Pollard, where they introduced a mechanism called the marine ice cliff instability. Now, the details don't matter, but what they found was that by introducing this mechanism, which is theoretically entirely reasonable, you know, from theory, it totally makes sense. It just hasn't really been observed in the present-day ice sheets. By including it, they were able to reproduce past ice sheet sort of changes in volume during previous warm periods, in particular a period called the Pliocene about 3.5 million years ago. And including this marine ice cliff instability mechanism in their model made, in particular, the East Antarctic much more sensitive to climate warming than models had suggested previously. And I think part of the higher numbers that we're coming up with now is due to the experts' belief that this is a plausible mechanism. And one thing I should stress about the numbers that you quoted, the 1 meter and the 2 meter, those are not what we call the most likely scenario. They're not the mean or the median estimates from the experts. They're the upper tails, the 5% probability, what some policymakers might call the worst case scenario. You know, the relatively low probability. I mean, not that low. It's a 1 in 20 probability. Low probability, high impact. But what is indicated from our analysis is that mechanism has made the experts feel that the Antarctic ice sheet could potentially contribute more than we previously believed to sea level rise. And I think there's a second factor that has quite strongly influenced expert judgment in the last 6 years, which is that our observations of the ice sheets, and that's an area that I've worked in quite a bit over the last few years, are quite short. They're only about the sort of high-quality observations from satellites are only 25 to 30 years long in terms of the length of the record, and that's quite short in terms of a climate record. It's quite short to determine whether you're seeing a trend or just natural variability in the system. But when you look at that record, mass loss from West Antarctica and from Greenland has roughly been steadily increasing over time. And many of the models of West Antarctica and Greenland haven't really predicted that behavior. And so, again, I think what that's suggesting to the experts is that actually, in particular, Greenland and West Antarctica are a bit more sensitive to climate forcing than we previously thought. And I think if you combine those two factors together, it's given the experts the sort of the view, the judgment that both ice sheets, all three, there's Greenland and then Antarctica is usually split into West Antarctica and East Antarctica, that all three of them are more sensitive to climate change than we thought, say, back in 2012 when we did the previous study.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, your nonprofit program on climate and the environment. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Jonathan Bamber from the University of Bristol. We're talking about the great melting ice world and seas rising around hundreds of millions of people. So I guess the Climate Central study on the millions exposed to sea level rise looks at several scenarios, and the worst combines continued high emissions as now with what they call Antarctic instability. And I guess that's what you were just talking about, the Antarctic instability?
It's exactly that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the acronym is MICI, Marine Ice Cliff Instability, which was, I mean, proposed a while back, but the first kind of really important paper on it was published in 2016, so that's quite recent.
Jonathan, you work on calculating ice loss from places like Greenland, and a group of scientists, including James Hansen and Andrew Glickson, are watching that cold blob of meltwater collecting south of Greenland. Do you think an onslaught of colder fresh water from the glaciers could change ocean currents or even the weather in places like your home in the UK?
Okay, so that again is an area that we in my group have worked on quite a bit. And the technical term, or the term oceanographers use, is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the AMOC. And there have been quite a lot of studies looking at whether the strength of the AMOC, which releases a lot of heat in the polar North Atlantic just south of Greenland and keeps Northwest Europe much warmer than it would be without it, whether that could be shut down or whether it could be weakened by lots of melt from the Greenland ice sheet. And I think the jury is still out on that one. I think the latest evidence, we published a paper about 3 years ago on this, is that it looks like the Greenland ice sheet in the next decades could have some impact on the AMOC. It seems unlikely that it's going to shut down, that you're going to have a, you know, something like the sort of day after tomorrow type scenario where, you know, suddenly, I don't know, the Hudson River freezes over or whatever it was that they had in that film. The evidence right now suggests that you're not going to have a very dramatic, what we call in jargon, a tipping point in the climate system. But there does seem to be some reasonably compelling evidence to suggest that the AMOC could weaken as a consequence of increased freshwater fluxes from Greenland Arctic ice caps, and also from the rapidly melting Arctic sea ice as well, which is putting fresh water back into the Arctic Ocean and North Atlantic.
The other really strange thing to me, Jonathan Bamber, is that as the ice is lost from these continents and they lose mass, which you measure even from satellite measurements, then the sea level rise right around Greenland and Antarctica might actually go down. Is that true?
Yeah, that is a bit of an odd one. You know, I'm a professor in a university, so I teach undergraduates, and one of my favorite topics is this. It's called self-gravitation, and because it's really counterintuitive, and I think, you know, the students, once they get it, they find it really sort of just incredible that this sort of thing happens. But so the sea, the surface of the sea follows something called the geoid, the shape of the geoid. The geoid is just the gravity field around the Earth. So the surface of the ocean is not entirely flat. It goes up and down over long distances, depending on how much mass is underneath the ocean or how the gravity field of the Earth changes as a function of location, because it's not constant. You know, where you have a lot more mass, the gravity is a little bit stronger, and you get water being pulled towards that area. And so it accumulates, it sort of piles up in areas of stronger gravity. Where the gravity field gets weaker, then the opposite happens. Now, if you take a load of ice, and we're talking, I mean, huge volumes of ice, at the minute, the Greenland ice sheet is losing something like 280 to 300 gigatons of ice. A gigaton is 10 to the 9 tons. 1 gigaton is a cubic kilometer of ice.
Is that annually?
Annually. And so it's losing, let's say, around about 300 cubic kilometers of ice a year. You know, huge. That's a huge mass. So if you take that off the land and you stick it in the ocean, then the gravity field over Greenland itself actually goes down, gets weaker. And so the water, instead of piling up around Greenland, is sort of does the opposite. It sinks. And so you're absolutely right. What you originally said is that sea level will go down close to Greenland. And what's called in the far field, thousands of kilometers away from Greenland, it actually goes up by more than the sort of global mean as a consequence. So it's quite a counterintuitive process. There's another really wacky thing that happens as well. You know, the Earth is spinning on its axis, and if you take the mass off Greenland and you stick it in the ocean, then based on this principle or law, which is conservation of angular momentum, then the axis of rotation of the Earth to change to conserve angular momentum. Does that make sense?
Not totally yet.
Yeah, well, okay. Do you know what a gyroscope is?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you have a little gyroscope spinning on a table, and it's spinning round, and it stays upright because of the wheel that's spinning round, which is weighted. Now, if you get a piece of gum, and you stick that gum not on the axis of rotation, but you stick it on the side of the gyroscope a little bit, let's say two-thirds of the way down, then the gyroscope is going to tilt over towards where that gum is because you've changed the distribution of mass on the gyroscope. And to conserve this angular momentum, the rotating momentum, the axis of rotation, you know, your spinning point, needs to change. I mean, the other example is, you know, if you take a bicycle wheel and you spin it round and then you put your finger on the end, it tips down. It's exactly the same thing. And we're talking, I mean, very small changes in the angle of rotation of the Earth, but they're large enough to be measured by accurate geodetic instruments and to actually change the distribution of water in the longitudinal east-west direction.
On the larger scale, I am hearing rumbles from august German scientists and institutions that the current scientific method and the political system for handling climate change is not working. Just this week, IPCC stalwart Dr. Robert Watson is reporting the Paris Agreement will not slow down global warming. So on a personal level, Jonathan Bamber, is it time to freak out about climate change?
That's a difficult question to answer. I would say, in a way, no. I think we should have freaked out about climate change 30 years ago, personally. We're very late to the table on this one. You know, in the last 30 years, over half of the CO2 emissions since the Industrial Revolution have been emitted. So, I mean, that's done and dusted. You know, we can't go back in time. But I think, absolutely, we should have been, and to be fair, many scientists, including people like Jim Hance and actually a number of other eminent scientists in the US, have been shouting out about this message since the 1980s. I don't know. Something seems to have happened in the last year or so. I think a number of different things and factors have come into it. The public and the politicians sort of really do seem to be getting the message now. So we're having an election in the UK, as I think you probably know, on the 12th of December, so just like a few weeks away now. And one of the major election manifesto items by the Labour Party is related to climate change because they think it matters to the public. Now, that's the first time that that's been really high on the agenda, you know, right at the top of the agenda in the UK. And I should say in Germany, issues around the environment are seem to be number one in terms of political choices. So I think we are starting to get a message, but crikey, we really need to crack on because time is very short.
We have been speaking with ice expert Jonathan Bamber. He is a professor at the University of Bristol, UK, and a source of authoritative papers on the disappearing ice world on planet Earth. And to find out more, you can use links to the science we just talked about and some of the media coverage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for generously sharing your time with us, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a Radio EcoShock special on the new future of rising seas. Two scientific experts explain previous gross underestimates of just how many people will be flooded out as the world warms. It could be six times as many, hundreds of millions of people. At the high end, at our current rate of emissions, that is, almost one in seven people on the planet will be facing salt water in their homes, businesses, streets, and farms at least once a year. Whoever is wealthy enough and has the foresight must begin construction of massive surge defenses now, this year. But millions of farmers and city dwellers, well, retreat will be the only option. Please pass this program on to others. You can find easy play buttons in the blog for each program at ecoshock.org. Or listen on SoundCloud. Retweet my show tweet. Reading short news accounts is one thing, or a few seconds on TV, but hearing the scientists at the source, it's another. That's one thing we do here at Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
With climate, there is shocking news and super shocking news. We just learned that many more humans could be flooded out by rising seas, hundreds of millions more people possibly than we thought. Published October 29, 2019, the new study is titled New Elevation Data Triple Estimates of Global Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Coastal Flooding. The authors are Scott Culp and Benjamin Strauss, both from the nonprofit news source Climate Central. Our guest, Dr. Benjamin Strauss, is CEO and chief scientist for Climate Central. From Princeton, New Jersey, Ben, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks so much for having me.
As a scientist, you study sea level rise, and your bio credits you as, quote, the architect of the surging seas suite of maps, tools, and visualizations. How does that tie in with the paper just released in Nature Communications?
Well, really, it's just a continuation of the ongoing work we've been doing for the last 10 years or so. In this case, we're extending work that has mostly been focused on the United States to global coverage.
And your new paper talks about extreme coastal water level. What do you mean by that?
We mean water levels that are beyond your day-to-day usual. So we do assess land below projected high tide lines in the future as sea levels continue to rise. But we assess land below the projected annual flood level, which is one flavor of an extreme coastal water level. Extreme coastal water level is a little bit scientist speak, but the annual flood level is one that you expect to be exceeded once a year on average. So some years it might not happen at all, but other years it might happen twice. Over the course of 10 years, you'd expect it to happen 10 times. So basically, you don't want to live on land lower than that or get flooded that often unless you build coastal defenses or have some other way to accommodate. Obviously, it wouldn't be acceptable to have salt water in your living room once a year on average.
Right, that's very damaging. Now, the shocking thing to me was that we didn't know, really, the elevation of the Earth in so many key places along the coasts. Ben, how would you explain the problems with using NASA's Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, or SRTM?
The heart of this research was we looked someplace that the scientific community was not looking. Almost all the effort in sea level science and climate science is to project the future. What will future sea levels be? How will the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica change? And those are really difficult questions, and it's hard to know. But all of our eyes have been on those moving objects, and we realized that you really need to know two things, the height of the water, which is changing, but also the height of the land, in order to understand how many people are at risk. And in 2014, my colleague Scott and I realized that there was a big problem with the global elevation data produced by NASA for using it for this purpose. Basically, we're standing on NASA's shoulders, to be clear. Their data is tremendous and has been a very important global service. But it's just not that well suited to coastal flood risk analysis. And the reason is that it was based on a satellite mission on the Space Shuttle Endeavour flown in February 2000, and they used radar technology to basically estimate the elevation of land, the distance from the satellite. But the footprint of that signal that came down was about 100 feet in diameter, and blended in information from rooftops and treetops as well as the ground. So the average elevation that bounced back to the satellite, in effect, was more than 6 feet too high on average in coastal zones, according to our research. And that's what we've worked to improve.
So how did you get around that to get more accurate pictures of where the land really is?
We took the NASA data. We took more than 20 other variables, and we basically put them into a blender using artificial intelligence to come up with an approach that essentially removes the effect of buildings and trees. And the way that we know that it works is by comparing the results of our approach against places where we actually have very accurate readings of elevation. And it turns out our model works very well when we test it in that way. And even when we test it in places that are far away from the places that we used for building the model in the first place.
So this new digital elevation model reported in your paper, it checks against 23 variables, including things like vegetation and buildings, as you mentioned. And the computer power to do that on a global scale must be incredible. Talk to us about what Scott Culp brings to this project.
Well, Scott Culp has been an incredible collaborator with me for many years now, and he just has a knack for solving thorny big data problems very efficiently. That's what a strong computer scientist or big data expert can do. The idea of what you're trying to accomplish may not be so hard if you look at it at a micro scale, but then when you multiply it against the whole Earth, it's a lot of computation that you have to do. So you have to find very efficient ways, and Scott is really a genius at that. And we are fortunate to have benefited from the development of machine learning and AI technologies. So certainly there are improving packages that were available for us to use to help us. We didn't have to do it all from scratch.
Well, then we all want to know how this story turns out. Let's start with the low emissions scenario. What is the new estimate of how many people currently live below the projected high tide lines for the year 2100 if we manage to keep warming at 2 degrees C?
So I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but a key point here is that we can make a significant difference between a high emission scenario versus a low emission scenario in terms of the exposure of people at the end of the century. There's not a huge difference at the middle of the century because most of the sea level rise between now and mid-century is already in the pipeline. Sea level is still catching up. The glaciers and ice sheets are still catching up to the warming that we have already caught. But there really can be a meaningful difference by the end of the century, and certainly beyond the end of the century, depending on what carbon pathway we follow. And I think one of the big, the other side of the coin for our analysis, which shows that more than three times as many people are at risk as we thought, the other side of the coin is the benefit of cutting climate pollution is far greater than we thought. So the benefit-cost equation may really change here. There's a lot more harm that we can avoid if we can cut emissions.
In your vulnerability numbers, are you talking about territory that just totally disappears under the waters or a once-a-year flood or what?
That's a great question. We present territory that would be either below high tide line, effectively becoming part of the ocean environment. And we also give numbers that show how much land would be below the annual flood level, so occasional flooding, but increasing at increasing frequencies. Something else that's really important to understand is we did not have data on coastal defenses like levees as part of this study. We couldn't find any global data on that. So part of our analysis found that there are 110 million people already living on land below high tide line, according to our analysis. And that tells us two possible things. One, that there are coastal defenses already in place protecting those people. Two, that our data may underestimate elevation. Say the elevation is too low in some places, or some combination. It's probably a combination of those things, because we do know that a lot of people are already protected by levees in places as far-ranging as the Netherlands or Jakarta, Shanghai, or Guyana in South America. So the fact that so many people are already protected by coastal defenses to some degree does indicate the potential to build on those defenses and build new defenses in the future as well. So it's another kind of little bit of hopefulness, I guess, in our findings. Although, of course, most of the places that are protected by defenses today, I think, were probably developed at or below sea level in a way that left space for those defenses, and it may be quite a different matter to protect cities that were developed with the assumption that they would always be above sea level. But I wouldn't say that our analysis says all of these places are going to disappear. Some will, but others will be defended, and in other cases, there are places where we may have put the elevation data too low, some other places where we put it too high. It's certainly not the last word. And one of the things I hope that will come out of our research is to stimulate more governments and corporations to collect better elevation data in our coastal areas, to do it directly so that we don't have to rely on things like artificial intelligence to make our best estimate of what the elevation is, but rather we have a very high quality direct measurement. We will never know the future sea level with certainty, but we can know the elevation of land with certainty. And I think maybe the biggest contribution of our research is to show how wrong we're getting elevation globally, and that this problem can be addressed. And it has a huge effect on our estimate of the risk, much bigger than the effect of the current refinements happening in sea level projections and sea level science. So since it's possible to get this right, let's invest and get it right.
I would add just one minor caveat, and that is that some places, like Jakarta, is sinking mainly because people are draining the groundwater out from underneath it, and New England is somewhat sinking on a very slow scale due to subsidence after the glaciers left. So even the ground level is not exactly stable.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Jakarta has such a big problem there, moving the capital to, the president announced that they're going to move the capital to a new location on a different island.
I'll believe that when I see it, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see if that really happens. I mean, it's a city of tens of millions of people, so it's pretty stunning.
And they're very attached to Java. I've been there, and it's very difficult to get people to move off the main island. Well, look, the main point of your study, and I think maybe the most shocking part, is that you find unimaginable risk developing in Southeast Asia as the earth warms and those sea levels go up. Where are the highly populated areas most likely to experience what we might even call ocean floods during this century?
Well, we found really large risks across Southeast Asia and extending into South Asia, India and Bangladesh, and around the East Asia, China. China actually has the largest number by far of people living on land vulnerable to falling below the high tide line or chronic flooding. But the biggest multiples of threat were in South and Southeast Asia. So Thailand, if you assess the population in Thailand on low-lying coastal land using the old NASA data, you get around 1 million for, I think, levels that could be below the level of an annual flood by mid-century. And in our analysis, that goes up to around 12 million, so a more than a tenfold increase. India and Bangladesh go up seven or eightfold. And there are also some pretty big factors in Vietnam and other Southeast Asian countries. Philippines and Indonesia also have a really high risk, high multiples and high total risk.
And people think, well, that's far away, that won't affect me. But I remember a couple of years ago there were floods in Thailand, and it turns out that almost all of our hard drives for computing power comes from a few factories there, and they went under. And I wonder, does your new mapping tool suggest that there are threats to Chinese production zones as well?
Well, you're quite right that so many of these Asian megacities are vital nodes in global supply chains for all kinds of things. So absolutely, in a global economy, flooding problems in Asia are going to affect others around the world, including the U.S. and Canada. It's also the case, look at the Syrian conflict, actually. The roots of the Syrian conflict were in a drought, and that drought had climate change fingerprints on it. And the conflict has produced a stream of migrants and refugees, some of whom have fled to Europe. along with some sub-Saharan Africans also going to Europe. And that has produced incredible political instability, not to mention the suffering in Syria and Africa, but also instability in Europe. I mean, that flow of refugees is like a trickle compared to what we could have in the future because of rising sea levels if we're unable to effectively defend land. If, for example, across the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, most places are undefendable and you have farmers who used to farm rice there, you know, their fields become salty and they go to the cities and then you have social unrest and kind of internal movements of refugees and movements between countries creating political unrest or even regional conflict in the longer run. So those kinds of effects could have direct humanitarian consequences where they take place, but they also can affect global supply chains and they can affect global politics as well and national security. I mean, who wants to see Asia turn into a tinderbox of conflict because of climate change? I think that would be very damaging for the West as well as for Asia.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, getting climate science to you straight from the source. Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Strauss, chief scientist and leader at Climate Central. Well, as we speak, and strangely, millions of people still have the dream of moving towards the coasts. I think about half of Americans live within 100 miles of the coasts. This could even increase the exposure counts that, I guess, were these in your new models, the figures for possible migration?
No, we did not include the fact that the current trend is for population growth in coastal areas, just direct growth and through migration. So in that respect, we could be underestimating the threat. And we actually, where we were able to test it in the United States and Australia, we find that we're underestimating the threat compared to what you would get using more accurate elevation data from LIDAR, laser range finder technology. So no, we're not factoring that. It could be a much bigger threat.
Would your new digital elevation models be able to predict, either forward or backward in time, floods like the ones that hit Venice in 1966 or New Orleans in 2005?
It's a good question. I don't see why not. I think for New Orleans, it would be a challenge because levees are such an important part of the picture there. But I think raising New Orleans does raise an issue that's important to understand here. Even if we can defend most of the Asian megacities with levees, let's say, if engineering and coastal defenses can prevent the kind of relocations that we were just talking about, one question to ask is, how deep a bowl is anyone going to want to live inside? And New Orleans gives a good case study because much of that city is already below sea level. It's protected by levees. And Hurricane Katrina in 2005 shows what can happen when those defenses fail. And the consequences can be quite tragic because the flood comes swiftly. You don't have time to escape. When you're at the bottom of the bowl, the water and the defenses are breached, the water rises very swiftly. And most of the cities around the Asian rim are in places that could be hit by powerful cyclones. And we've seen some incredibly dangerous cyclones in that part of the world over the last number of years, not to mention the possibility of terrorist or other attacks on coastal defenses.
Or tsunamis.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the tsunami comes over your defense, and then suddenly all that water, it can't escape back out to the ocean once it comes through. So coastal defenses can give you a measure of security and protect you against the milder events, but they can actually create a far more dangerous situation for the more extreme events.
Even in America, you and Scott Culp say, quote, sea level rise this century may induce large-scale migration away from unprotected coastlines, redistributing population density across the country and putting great pressure on inland areas, end quote. That doesn't sound good for high-priced coastal real estate or the big banks who carry those mortgages, does it?
No, it doesn't. Research by others suggests that coastal real estate prices in the United States are already lower than they should be for homes in the very lowest of elevations above the high tide line. doesn't mean that those values are falling, but it means at the very least that they're not climbing as quickly as they would be if the homes were on higher ground. And I expect we will see an acceleration of that trend over time. Also, anecdotally, there certainly are pockets and neighborhoods along U.S. coasts where homes have essentially lost all of their value and residents are trapped. I've seen the stories of people, it's their biggest piece of equity, their home, and now they're flooding multiple times a year. They can't sell. The only homes that sell in that neighborhood, you know, sell for $20,000 or $30,000. That's it. So people essentially become trapped. And either they have to live with the mold and the floods and the damage, replacing their appliances or somehow moving their kitchen up to their bedroom on the second floor, or else they have to lose their biggest piece of equity unless the government comes in to defend them. And right now, the way the Army Corps works, at least, they do a benefit-cost analysis, so they mainly protect wealthy neighborhoods with high real estate values so that the benefit-cost equation looks good. And from a local perspective, those are, of course, the greatest sources of tax revenue, so there's also incentives to protect. So, yeah, we definitely have a real problem here in the United States already.
Ben Strauss, you lead an organization called Climate Central. Briefly, what is Climate Central? Who founded it, and what do you do?
Climate Central is a research and news organization dedicated to communicating climate changes, effects, and solutions to American and broader publics and decision makers. We particularly try to make climate tangible and local because while it's a global phenomenon, people experience it locally, and we work to make these big changes very tangible and filled with local meaning for people, to cut across ideology, geography, political viewpoint, because we're all in this boat together.
We may need a boat from the sounds of things.
Yes. Well, indeed. Our planet is one boat in the solar system and the universe. It really is.
Let's talk about how to handle all this new information. What tools does your website offer for the public?
So one tool we offer is our Surging Seas suite of coastal maps, the one we just published, which is at coastal.climatecentral.org. We also offer something called Risk Finder at riskfinder.org, which provides extensive analysis by zip code, by city, by county of coastal places around the U.S. And if you come to our main website, climatecentral.org, and click on the media library link, we have an extensive library of thousands of graphics illustrating in simple, powerful TV suitable ways, or teaching suitable ways, or PowerPoint suitable ways, illustrating climate science and climate impacts and climate solutions, both at national and global levels, but principally at local levels in the United States. So you can find graphics that document, for example, trends in warming or precipitation or the prevalence of pollen or poison ivy by individual media market throughout the country.
Some scientific publications require authors to write a plain language summary along with the technical abstract, and frankly, I wish you had done that with this important paper. It's a bit technical to go through. But even so, your new study got a lot of traction in mainstream media, the New York Times to the BBC. So this bad news is shocking, but I wonder, will it really drive up international demand for action? I mean, what does this new paper do for us? Where does it go?
Well, first, I would invite you and your listeners to come to our website. And if you go to that coastal site, you can download more of a layperson's report that we also wrote to complement the paper and explain things a bit more accessibly. We've been tracking, and this has been covered by more than 2,000 media outlets so far in 100 countries. It was cited by the Secretary General of the UN. And we've had more than 500 requests for our new elevation data from around the world, largely the research community. So from the response that we're seeing, yes, there's been a lot of attention, and we're optimistic that now many different research groups will be able to use our data to deepen understanding of our coastal threat through, you know, many more approaches and research lines than we could possibly engage in on our own.
When we get shocking news, it can be a little bit emotional, too. And my first emotions, first of all, I was a little bit angry. I thought, well, why weren't we told there was this big problem and underestimate sooner? But the second was more mature. It was sadness, thinking about the hard times to come that our ancestors might not have been able to imagine. How do you handle the big, ugly picture, Ben? And tell us the truth, is big sea level rise now inevitable?
Well, I think a certain amount of depression or pessimism or just difficult feelings are an occupational hazard if you're a climate scientist. My personal philosophy is that it's never too late to do better. And I try and, for me, the meaning is in trying to do something. I don't see any alternative in looking at this big problem besides asking what's the most that I can do as an individual. And the most I can ask of myself is to do what I can in the direction of trying to confront this great challenge.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to tell our radio and podcast listeners?
Well, I think you've given a really thorough interview. I think if we, to the degree that we lick this problem, to the degree that we solve it, I do think it could be counted as the greatest achievement in all of human civilization. I don't think we necessarily expect that we will be able to head off a pretty catastrophic change. It's looking pretty poor in a lot of ways, but it is never too late to do better, to reduce the chance of some of the really frightening consequences that we could see. And if somehow we can pull it together. I think of climate change as really the easiest hard problem. We're never going to solve, I believe, we're never going to solve human conflict or disease or poverty or justice, right? These are deep human struggles that will continue for all of human history. But climate change is different. We actually know how to solve it. We have the technology that we need. It's the easiest of all the problems, as big as it may seem. What makes it extra hard is the time limit, is the fact that we really need to act now and in the next 10 years, the next 20 years. If you think of our descendants far in the future, many generations, suppose we could solve disease. They wouldn't care if we solved it this year or in 100 years, but they would care everything about whether we kick our carbon habit this year, in 10 years, or in 50 years. It will make a world of difference. So we do have time pressure. The climate is solvable. And if we do it, it really would be, I think, human civilization's greatest achievement.
It could be our finest hour if we beat it. We have been speaking with Dr. Benjamin Strauss, CEO and Chief Scientist for Climate Central, at climatecentral.org. I will put links for the new paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org as well. Ben, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us. We do need to know this.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This challenge is part of the fabric of our whole civilization. CO2 is the exhaling breath of our civilization, literally. And now we've mechanized that process. Changing that pattern requires a scope, a scale, a speed of change that is beyond what we have done in the past. So that's why I began by saying, be optimistic in what you do, but be an active citizen. Demand, change the light bulbs, but change the laws. Change the global treaties. We have to speak up. We have to solve this democracy. We have sclerosis in our democracy, and we have to change that. Use the internet. Go on the internet. Connect with people. Become very active as citizens. Have a moratorium. We shouldn't have any new coal-fired generating plants that aren't able to capture and store CO2, which means we have to quickly build these renewable sources. Now, nobody is talking on that scale, but I do believe that between now and November, it is possible. This Alliance for Climate Protection is going to launch a nationwide campaign, grassroots mobilization, television ads, internet ads, radio, newspaper, with partnerships with everybody from the Girl Scouts to the hunters and fishermen. We need help. We need help.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.